Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Now for more than a week, dozens of students have occupied the offices of Mateo Ricci College, a small humanities college at Seattle University. They say the curriculum minimizes the experiences of people of color. They want some big changes. The university says it's willing to make big changes there, but they are not willing to budge on another major student demand, the immediate resignation of the dean. Fourth-year student Fiza Mohammed helped organize the protests. She described for us what a typical day is like occupying the college offices now for more than a week.
We wake up at like 7, 6:30, clean up all the beds, all the bedding, everything. We start with like prayer and intention and make sure everyone's feeling okay, everyone's health is okay. If folks need to go home and be in their own beds, then we send them home. And then we start to strategize.
What does your group want the university to do?
We want radical change within Mateo Ricci College, and we want more spaces within Seattle University to speak on issues regarding race and gender and just liberation in general. We really want a liberatory education. This is what we all expected. Whether or not we had the language to describe that at 17, 18 years old, we all truly wanted, especially the black and brown students who are in the coalition right now, really desired an education that centered us and was liberatory. And so we want the university to, first of all, like, recognize that, and we know that none of that can happen while a racist dean is in office. And so we're demanding the immediate resignation of Dean Kelly.
And we're gonna talk about your demands. I first want to talk about how you got to this college. You were a high school student in the Bay Area. You get accepted to this little Jesuit college in Seattle with 200 students. You know it's part of a small Catholic university and that it specializes in a humanities education, Latin, Greek, all of that stuff. Why did you decide to go?
Well, I went to a Catholic high school. I went to an all-girls Catholic high school that was really radical and that truly did center people of color in many ways. And so I had a very good, very powerful experience in the Bay Area going to a Catholic high school in San Jose. I chose Seattle University because it was marketed to me as being socially just. It was marketed to me as being a university in which students were graduating with a critical consciousness, being literate in a critical consciousness. And I chose Mateo Ricci College because it was projected as a progressive, experimental humanities program. And when I was thinking of humanities, I assumed that it would be a global humanities program. You know, when you think of humanities, philosophy, scholarship, you think of the rest of the world as well. You know, you think of all of humanity. So I was really expecting a program that would be rigorous in developing like my own intellect, but would also give me the space to do the community organizing work that I was drawn to and didn't really know much about.
So you thought you were going to get this socially progressive, experimental education of your hopes, and then what happened during your time here in Seattle to that you ended up now occupying the offices of the Seattle University College?
Yes. It's really heartbreaking. But I think my freshman year, I believed, you know, the things that were said to me as an 18-year-old coming in, things like, oh, you know, the way that you speak is too urban and you'll never be successful because of it. Things like that I just absorbed.
Who told you that you give the example of you speak too urban, you won't succeed? Who told you that?
Faculty in MRC.
Faculty.
Faculty in Mateo Ricci College. And it wasn't until my junior year when there were other professors who intervened in my education, essentially, in other departments, that I started to gain the language to deconstruct what was happening to me and started to deconstruct what was happening to other students as well.
What's another example of what you encounter there that really, really disappointed and let you down?
Anytime that I would try to advocate for myself, or try and speak to a perspective that I had and had seen in my communities, I was truly silenced There were professors in my classrooms who were very, I think, threatened by the things that I was saying in terms of like calling people out on whiteness and white privilege, and who were always ready to come to the support of white students but had very little to offer in supporting me.
Fissa, you are at a little college in Seattle University, a private school that can do what it wants. Mm-hmm. It's not an arm of the government. Why don't you just go to a different school?
Yes, that's a good question. And that's a question that's been asked of us multiple times. Many of us are on scholarship. The scholarship that I have gives me a full ride to this university. And also for students who are in Mateo Ricci College, it is very difficult to leave. Our core is different from the rest of the university. Even if I wanted to leave, it would become difficult in my sophomore year to leave. It would be difficult to have my credits transfer if I wanted to do another major, or I would be here for another year, 2 years. And so that's how I was caught, essentially, in Mateo Ricci College. I wanted to leave, and I couldn't leave.
Finally, Fissa, a bigger picture question here. You know that a humanities education is very much about critical thinking. It is about engaged debate. Your college experience is about being around people who don't think the same way you do.
Yeah.
How do you know when you're... How would you know if you have become too rigid in your demands and you're missing the point of your education?
I think, I would just encourage people to come to the occupation and see how folks are interacting with guests. This is, we are very hospitable. We are very willing to engage questions and to interact with folks' with very real concerns. I think an image is being projected about us as being, very aggressive. And
we are occupying the office of the college and calling for the dean to be forced out.
Mm-hmm. We're not willing to compromise on these demands because we have been trying to push our simple demands for a very long time. We've been pushed to this. And the occupation is a beautiful space. Honestly, we have created a very, very beautiful space in this college that hasn't, that has never existed within Mateo Ricci. The work that's being done in the past 8-9 days that we've been there is, has been very liberating and healing for many of us.
Fissa Muhammad, we so appreciate you talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
And good luck in your studies, too.
Yes, thank you. Appreciate it.
Fissa Muhammad, student at Mateo Ricci College, which is a small college focusing on the humanities, part of Seattle University. Now, the college administration declined to speak with us on the air. They did send a link to some letters from the president of SU detailing the changes the university is willing to make and what changes they are not willing to make. And we're tweeting out that link right now at KUOW. It's KUOW's The Record. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill Radke. All of us are at some risk of cancer, heart disease, diabetes, but it is so much harder to manage a chronic illness if you are homeless. Dr. Marilissa Bond works nights at Harborview Medical Center. She sees patients who come to the emergency room. About half of them are homeless, and she thinks differently when she's treating them.
I really have to be mindful of the things that are feasible for my homeless population patients. So, for example, things as simple as how to access medical care, how to access medications, how to store their medications in a safe place so that they don't get stolen or lost along the way, how to take their medications, at the same time every day if that's what they're supposed to be doing. Things like, we make a lot of dietary recommendations to people. And when I think about my homeless population and my homeless patients, I think about, what kinds of access to food do they have? And if I'm making recommendations, one of the things that I have to really focus on and think about is where is the food coming from? How reliable is this food source? And food insecurity itself is a large challenge for my patients.
I want to talk about a patient maybe who you're thinking of right now, someone you know. Give us a picture of that person's life and why this is so hard for them.
Sure. One of the more surprising and thought-provoking interactions that I had recently was with one of the patients who came in and told me the story of how, you know, about a month or so prior, he had his socks and shoes had gotten wet. He was homeless and living in various places, sometimes housed in a vehicle, sometimes housed under, you know, whatever overpass or bridges he could find shelter in. And he was having a really hard time keeping his feet warm and dry. And he started to develop some pain in the feet, and he didn't really think too much of it at first, kind of kept walking around and kind of doing all the things he needed to do in his sort of daily struggle, even to find food, find shelter. And the pain became more and more and more severe. And by the time I saw him, he had actually lost feeling in both of his feet. And actually the tissue had started to die and decay. And he ultimately needed to have quite significant amputations of his feet because of essentially what we would call trench foot, just this immersion in cold and moisture and the inability to rest, stay off his feet, and have access to basic things like clean and dry socks and shoes. And for me, that was kind of a significant moment to think, you know, this is something that is not always or not specifically a medical problem per se. It's kind of it crosses over many boundaries in terms of how we are dealing with our homeless issue and how the intersection of medical problems and social problems kind of comes to a head for this population.
Yeah, we think of donate socks to homeless people. I don't think all of us are picturing how what a medical issue. Right. This is not just about warmth.
Right, right.
Tell me about that intersection between medical and social.
For me, it comes up on a daily basis.
What's an example of that?
So, for example, when I think about seeing a patient and trying to decide whether or not to admit this patient into the hospital, one of the considerations that I'm trying to make is, does this person have the ability to, or the support to follow up with some of the basic preventive medical care or basic medical recommendations that I might give someone? And if somebody doesn't have the ability to do that, they oftentimes will come into the hospital for what otherwise might be a relatively minor and treatable issue, just so we can really get ahead of it, as opposed to sending them back to the street without enough support to take care of their issues.
We might forget the kind of support we have around us mm-hmm. if we have some place to live.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that it's not just about our chart from our doctor, right?
Right.
We might take for granted what support we have
right.
to heal.
Absolutely. And as I've gone through this process of getting to know this population that we serve, I've had to be much more mindful about the recommendations I'm making and the assumptions that I make about what some of my patients can and cannot do outside of the hospital. I had one patient tell me that he was doing a pretty good job of keeping his wound clean, but the fast food restaurant that he was using the bathroom in, they started to kind of crack down on his ability to use their bathroom to keep himself clean. And it's a significant issue when you really think about what sources of fresh water and cleanliness and just basic sanitation do you have. So I ask very pointed questions about those sorts of things when I'm trying to figure out whether or not someone is going to be able to follow kind of the basic recommendations that we might give them for their medical care.
So knowing what you know, Dr. Bond, how should we think differently about our healthcare system?
I think it's important to recognize the way in which the medical system has taken on a lot of the burden of homelessness in kind of the examples that I've described so far in terms of things that have either progressed to a degree that they might not otherwise have progressed to, or in the sense that we're doing a lot more intensive intervention for things that otherwise, if people had stable living environments, could be done on an outpatient basis. So I think first identifying that this is a significant stressor to the healthcare system, and then also kind of identifying the idea that shelter is a basic human necessity, and kind of viewing it even as a medical need, I think is an important first step. People really require a place to stay that's warm and dry and that they're able to stay out of the elements.
What do you want to say to a person who is homeless and maybe listening to you right now about their care, about what they can do?
We care. We want to help. We are equally frustrated about the fact that there's not an easy way to help in certain situations. So my message is really, there are people who care and want to establish ongoing relationships. I think when we see or hear about cases in aggregate and data that just, you know, is a statistic, it's a little bit easier for it to be anonymous and impersonal. But on a day-to-day basis, when I see people face-to-face who are telling me what their lives are like, it's incredibly hard to turn your back on those stories.
That is Dr. Marilissa Bond from Harborview Medical Center talking about what she calls the ongoing brutality of what it is to be sick without a home. We'll continue to cover issues around homelessness here on KUOW Seattle. Back in a moment. We are live tweeting the show right now at KUOW and talking about this. The Seattle International Film Festival opens tonight. Biggest film festival in America. 25 days, 421 films. This year, CIF is kicking things off with the North American premiere of Café Society, which is the new film by Woody Allen, produced by Amazon Studios. As you may know, Woody Allen's daughter says he sexually assaulted her when she was a child and spent years grooming her for the assault. Should CIF be celebrating Woody Allen tonight on opening night or at all? Given this unproven accusation, is Seattle kind of turning its back on victims of sexual abuse with tonight's party and showing? Or should you leave all of that in the lobby? Go enjoy or not enjoy Jesse Eisenberg and Kristen Stewart, and then get back to what we ought to do with Woody Allen's personal life. We're going to figure it out if we can now with Seattle Times columnist Nicole Broder. Hi, Nicole.
Hi, Bill.
And The Strangers arts and music editor Sean Nelson. Hi, Sean.
Hello.
Nicole, why should CIF, in your opinion, not be celebrating Woody Allen tonight?
Well,
Or is that accurate?
I think they should not have made his film the opening night gala event. They should not be the first film festival in North America to screen it, because I think Seattle and the film community here especially is very much about the underfunded underdog, very sensitive to issues surrounding abuse of many kinds and victims. And, you know, we've had films that have honored people who've come through some rough stuff and from all over the world. And we also have organizations here in the city that support young filmmakers and their voices, girls especially. And I just think it was a bad call.
Well, CIF says it's not their job to take on political issues, social, personal issues. That's They present stuff that now it's up to the audiences to judge. Why not roll the film on opening night and let people have their own opinions?
Because it's bringing a lot of attention to Woody Allen, and I probably didn't help the matter, you know, in writing about it. But I think they should have talked about it. And I don't know what went into the call other than Amazon Studios' involvement with Woody Allen and the.
What do you mean? You think that?
Well, they're a sponsor of
CIF.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Sean and I were talking about it before we came in today, and so that's a question. But if you're going to do this, as I said in the column the other day, you should have a panel, a group of writers and directors, and even audience members, anyone who wants to participate in kind of a conversation around just this thing, whether we can leave everything in the lobby and go in and enjoy a film, or if you just sit there feeling kind of creepy about the whole thing, which I do. I feel really creepy about it.
And Sean, I know you're not all in for Woody Allen, and you have complicated thoughts about this, but I had the impression you give CIF some points for not just going with a safe pick to open the festival.
Well,
you wrote that, didn't you?
I said that booking this movie is, I mean, CIF gets a lot of flack in the city and around for being comfortable and mainstream, and that booking this film, even though it is not itself probably a particularly transgressive piece of art.
It's a rom-com, probably.
Right. Well, Woody Allen's aesthetic merits as a filmmaker are many, but also there's lots of things to say about his films that are terrible too. So he's just made a lot of work, and that's all true. But I would say that in response to what you said before about Sif saying it's not our job to get involved with politics, and think by booking this film they are absolutely getting involved in politics, because that's what this film ultimately is about right now. In the fullness of time, when there is a body of work, and you know, when Woody Allen is dead, and we're all, you know, whatever, in, you know, in posterity's binoculars, the film Cafe Society will be about whatever Cafe Society is about, but for right now, Woody Allen is a figure who is accused of this really reprehensible thing. And that goes into a whole litany of stuff that has to do with women being believed about how they are, you know, about their accusations, about things like that. Men getting off because they are, sorry, it's a terrible choice of words, men getting a free ride and not being, you know, held to account for their actions because they're rich and powerful and white and all of those things. So I would say that it is a political act to screen Cafe Society.
It is a political act. Well, let's talk about, I guess if you want to call it politics and arts, because you're an actor, a writer, you're involved in the artistic community. We got a tweet from Steve who said, as a writer myself, I'd like to think I'll be judged on the totality of my life and not on my flaws and failings alone. When is it time to judge an artist's personal life?
Well,
this is an unproven accusation, by the way.
Yeah, I agree that it is unproven, and that makes it a thorny thing. But I also would like to say that Woody Allen is in no danger of being blacklisted. You know, I mean, he's incredibly well respected and regarded, and in fact has not been, you know, he's keeping on working, and his films are obviously being shown, and whatever struggles there might be to get his films produced, I don't know, and that's not really my area, but he's not a marginalized figure in the least.
If you were a marginalized figure, would you feel differently? A small filmmaker? Is that the point?
I guess so. Although I don't know. I mean, to separate the work from the artist is part of the job of being a connoisseur of the arts and just receiving it. But at the same time, there is this kind of, the exhibition of those films is that is its own art form, and that sort of curation of like what you're saying to the audience. That's the thing. That's the issue, and that's something that Nicole wrote about, I think, really, really well. And as I said just before we started, I think everyone in town was sort of like looking around furtively at each other, wondering who was going to say something. And it, you know, Nicole Broder was the first person to really speak of this publicly, because it's uncomfortable. There's really no denying it, and it might be way worse than uncomfortable, but it is at least uncomfortable.
Nicole, might you be wrong about what the Seattle film culture actually is? We have Seattle company Amazon producing it. We have Seattle International Film Festival putting it in their opening night slot. I assume many, many people will come tonight and watch the film. Is it not demonstrably a Seattle thing to do?
What do you mean?
To honor Woody Allen in this way? I just wonder is it actually who we are?
Maybe things have changed. I don't know. But I know the people that I know who are involved with SIFF and, you know, what they do. And the more the people who support SIFF and who go to the events and who I know from the galas and the film nonprofits like Real Girls specifically, and a lot of women who make film, you know, I can name a number of them, Megan Griffiths and Kate Bailey and
Lynn Shelton
and
Mel Esslin
and all the people all the people that I really love and admire, you know.
Are you going tonight?
No.
Sean?
I'm going, but as a reporter.
You're an actor. Would you work with Woody Allen?
That seems so unlikely on so many
levels. You never know.
Yeah. Hard to say.
Hard to say.
You don't want to. It's what do politicians say? They don't want to address a hypothetical. It seems. I literally can't even imagine the scenario in which that would be a possibility.
Yes, but you know the intent of the question.
Yeah, I do. I guess it depends on the part. No, I don't know. I mean, he has made some films that I think are. Well, he's made some of my favorite films.
Yeah.
By like
yours too, Nicole?
No question.
Very difficult. Even, you know, Manhattan is one of my favorite films. I had the posters up in my house for years. But even then, I noticed I was creeped out by his relationship with Mariel Hemingway. He was a 42-year-old comedy writer with a 17-year-old girl he picked up at the Dalton School after class.
Yeah, there's that background radiation to Woody Allen. So we have like 40 seconds left here. So very quickly, what is the proper attitude toward Woody Allen for, let's say, our listeners who are potentially viewers?
Think for yourself and speak your mind.
Exactly.
That's the proper attitude.
Yeah, exactly. Just know what's going on. Yeah, think for yourself and know going in. That's all.
And speak your mind. Nicole Broder and Sean Nelson, Stranger, Seattle Times. Thanks so much to both of you for coming.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. SIFF opens tonight with Woody Allen's Cafe Society tonight, 7 o'clock. McCall Hall, go or don't. Listen. Think for yourself and talk about it. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Nirvana, Pearl Jam, Weezer, Foo Fighters, all of them owe their massive success to Marco Collins. As a DJ for 107.7 The End here in Seattle, Marco Collins was the first person to play these bands on the radio. He's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame for breaking hit after hit and becoming a tastemaker and a gatekeeper in the music industry.
Without Marco as the loudspeaker, there's no way that alternative music becomes, you know, the global phenomenon that it became. No way.
That's a clip from a new documentary about Marco Collins. It's called The Glamour and the Squalor. Yes, both sides of his story are here, as well as the way he handled being quietly gay in a mostly straight world of grunge. First, Marco told me about his fascination for the dark side of things, which he connects to hearing a certain song for the first time. Happy House by Susie and the Banshees.
It was about the spookiest, most, you know, intense, just it frightened the hell out of me. When I heard that song, I remember sitting in a girlfriend's bedroom thinking, okay, now I don't get it. Now I really don't get it. But there's something I'm attracted to in how disturbed I am by it. I seem to be attracted to dangerous things. I don't know. Things that really destroy me or disturb me.
How did you start thinking, I want to expose other people to this disturbing or spooky stuff?
Yeah, I think.
Or whatever it was for you.
Yeah, I think, you know, radio was just exciting to me. And I was a kid that listened to the radio nonstop, you know, from when I can remember. I used to have 8 tracks. And you remember those, Bill?
Yes, I do.
Okay. It was one of those things that I would tape Casey Kasem. Because I wanted to hear those top songs.
I recorded Casey Kasem.
Yeah,
the top weekend top 40. It was Coast to Coast.
Yeah. Coast to Coast, exactly. It was
America's
amazing.
Top 40.
Yeah. I can hear the jingle
as
you say that in my head.
American Top 40.
Yeah, it was great, man. And I think I just was very attracted to the medium that you could share with people this knowledge and this information. And that, to me, was just very exciting. I did my first show when I was 16. And it was on an overnight at a community station in Northern California. And it didn't matter to me. I remember putting a 7-inch single on the turntable and hearing those opening riffs of Agent Orange, Everything's Got Gray. Just made me think, you're communicating with so many people that were like you at one point who had never heard this. And to me, I don't know, it's just exciting. It was something I was really drawn to.
You felt that when people started calling you at the station, or just the airing of the notes?
Yeah, just the notes. I pictured actually the notes going out on the airwaves. I pictured like the sounds actually, you know, climbing through the clouds and, like, you know, piercing other people's ears. It just was one of those things that to me was exciting. It's about communication. It's about sharing. And to me, music has to be enjoyed by more than one person. And that's always something. I can download every fantastic record in the world and listen to it by myself. But how much better does it sound when you're sharing it with somebody else? Like, so much better.
You were the one who, at least you get credit for sharing with everybody else, Nirvana, Pearl Jam, later bands after that. You would play stuff before anybody else did. What did you hear in songs?
I'm a fan of pop music, and people have touted me as being this alternative genius, and I just like pop songs, man. Like, you know, going all the way back to the Beatles, you know, and even before that, it's just a song structure that works in my head. It's not complicated at all. And to me, that's what I heard, and I knew that's what radio needed.
Marco Collins, you said that people want their rock stars to be rock stars, and that's who you thought you were. What do you mean by that?
I just remember thinking, if people are going to identify with my show, I need to live the lifestyle. I need to get out in the middle of it all and live the lifestyle. I need to be not just going to the shows. I need to be hanging out with the bands. I need to be partying with the bands. I need to be doing whatever the bands are.
Do you like doing that?
Yeah, it was a blast.
Okay,
it was a blast. And I like creative people. I get along very well with creative people. And it's inspiring for me to be around people that are, you know, so dynamic. So, yeah, it was a lot of fun. And when I first got here, I remember, so I started hanging out with a guy named Nils Bernstein. Nils ran the Nirvana fan club out of his apartment on Capitol Hill. And when Nirvana blew up, literally, I watched his living room. Like, this is a place we just all drank beer, crappy couch, you know, spilling beer all over the hardwood floors. You know, I watched his apartment get filled with fan mail from all over the world. Literally, we would have parties and dive into stacks of fan mail that were 3 feet high. And his mailman hated him. It was a great sort of place to be. But I remember once being over at Nils' house, and we were all getting together to watch Nirvana play on Saturday Night Live for the first time. We were all sitting on the couch, and it was Dan Peters from Mudhoney, and it was Kurt Block from the Fastbacks and the Young Fresh Fellows. It was like I looked around the room and thought, my God, this scene is tight. These are all the bands that the rest of the world are looking at, and we're all right here partying together. And I remember when Nirvana took the stage and everybody shut up. You know, everybody was drinking and unruly. Everybody shut up, got deadly silent. And when Nirvana's performance was over, you could hear a pin drop in that room. And it was, I get chills even talking about it. It was one of those moments that you really recognized that this grunge thing is way bigger than any of us had thought. These are Kurt's friends, you know, punk rockers and just crazy, maniacal fools, and they're all just shutting up and looking at the TV like they just saw one of the most important moments in pop culture history, and that's what it was.
So it was cool. It was fun. Were there any downsides to?
Of course, there were.
That life. Let's talk about that.
Okay. Well, you know, I mean, when you're in the thick of it all, there were a lot of drugs going on, and I ingested a lot of drugs back then. And, you know, some people in the scene didn't make it out. You know, some people OD'd and some people ended up taking their own lives because of, you know, whatever pressures were going on and whatever sort of drugs they were putting into their body. That part was rough. You know, that part was rough. But it was also, in a weird way, part of the beauty of it all, too. And I don't want to say that the destructive nature of it, but, you know, there's an element of pushing the boundaries that to me was fun. It's part of what we all did.
I can sort of understand why a musician who's got to get up for shows and has a weird schedule and can't sleep and then their life might be twisted around by money and attention and all that stuff and drugs being a part of that. Why were you taking drugs?
I liked it. I liked how it made me feel. So I would get off the air, start partying like a madman. And my rule was I had to be in bed by noon the next day to be able to do my radio shift again. So we raged all night. I mean, we raged, went to clubs. You know, at that time, the electronic thing had really taken off. I had turntables in my loft. It just really lended itself to the party. And it just got to be too much.
What did that, all that cost you?
Cost me a lot. I mean, it cost me.
And you know
me,
I don't just mean money. Obviously.
No, clearly. Yeah. In fact, money is the least of the concerns. You know, there's a huge trade-off. You trade off everything. You trade off relationships. That's a biggie for me, is walking away from, you know, relationships that I had been in. That, you know, could have been long-term, like, settling down kind of relationships. And I walked away from those. I walked away from, you know, a career. I blew up my career.
You mentioned relationships.
Yeah.
When you were on the air during the 90s, your listeners didn't know you were gay.
No.
Some, you know, Kurt Cobain and some other musicians knew.
The scene
but it
knew.
Was the scene
the
knew.
The scene knew, yeah.
Why didn't the rest of us know?
It was just a different time. It wasn't as acceptable to come out then, especially, you know, when you had a following. You know, my ratings were number one at nights. And my audience was 16-year-old kids, 16 to 18 to, you know, 24-year-old kids. It was mainly a very male, you know, oriented audience. And I just knew, they're not going to be down with this. And I can actually remember, you know, there were a couple scares where I thought, my audience has found out I was gay, you know, and then it ended up being sort of a really funny realization that maybe nobody does care. You know, maybe nobody really does care. So I'll tell you this. I came out in 1996 throughout magazine. They came to town to do a piece on gay musicians in Seattle. And they had Patty from Hole. They had myself. They had Nils, who ran Nirvana's fan club. They had a couple other artists. And they wanted to focus on people in the scene that were gay. And so I came out, and I was so nervous when Out Magazine was going to come out. The world was going to know. And then I realized, only gay people read Out Magazine. So, you know, you're real worried about this. It came out and, you know, I had a couple people that called me up and said, hey, we didn't know you were gay.
Any regrets?
Yes, I do have regrets. I have regrets that I didn't come out early because now I get emails from people that have grown up now and found their own way and come out on their own that said, if we had known that you were gay back then, it would have made it so much easier on us. And so, yeah, of course I have regrets. I mean, it would have been great to inspire a younger generation and just be sort of, well, I was far from a role model, but just be open about my sexuality to let other people know it's all right. I just wasn't that comfortable then. And I regret that. Yeah, I do.
Did being gay influence you, help you as a DJ, or a non-factor?
It helped me in this scene. You know, the Seattle scene. So I got here and I've always kind of had a very, I've never looked the alternative kid, you know, except for my high school years. I was really into the punk rock thing. I always looked like a soccer player, you know, just very mainstream frat boy looking soccer player. But it was when the scene found out that I wasn't just a California boy that was, you know, out of a fraternity here in town, that I was actually gay. They felt that, at least this is my take, that I was also a misfit in a way and fit into what they believed was a scene full of misfits.
Marco Collins, you're in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame as a DJ. You helped create all these successful bands or helped break these successful bands. As you know, radio doesn't have the same power as it did back then. What do you want to accomplish now in the music world?
Well, I don't totally agree with you that radio doesn't have the power
okay.
to break these artists or to be a part of, you know, pushing something over the top. What I think is happening is commercial radio is becoming terrified of it, and it's making room for stations like KCRW in Los Angeles, KCMU. Jeez, I'm throwing right back.
KEXP.
Thank you, KEXP. Just fantastic stations. WOXY. These stations are growing because people want something different. People want to hear the next thing. People want to be turned on to new bands.
What's your part in that today?
Hell, I don't know, Bill. I really don't know.
You're how old now?
I'm 51.
Yeah. So are you still trying to be a tastemaker, a band breaker?
Yeah. It's something that I don't think goes away. I do notice this, though. As my friends get older, they stop being interested in new music. And there's a study out there somewhere that says when you hit 32 or 33, you stop putting new music in your car. You're listening to only the things that you loved when you were younger. That never happened to me. I'm more excited about what's coming out in the next year. I'm excited about where music is going now. And I just, I keep my focus on that, because the moment I think you sort of rest, or the moment I rest and stop pursuing those new bands, is the moment that you can just put me to bed. You could put me in the retirement home and just, you know, I'll be done at that point.
Seattle DJ Marco Collins is in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, known for jump-starting the careers of Nirvana and Pearl Jam and so many others, including the Strangers, Sean Nelson, who was with us a few minutes ago talking about Woody Allen in the Seattle Film Festival. Sean was lead singer for Harvey Danger, and Marco Collins put their hit Flagpole Sitta on the air. Again, that film about his life, his journey, is called The Glamour and the Squalor. It's available on iTunes and Amazon Video, and we're tweeting out a link to the trailer right now at KUOW.